Welcome to the Product Quest podcast. Thanks for joining us in our journey to better understand innovation and product strategy. My name is Scott Burleson, and joining me as always, my co-hosts Jan Vermuth and Jonathan Edwards. Today, we welcome Brandon Cornuke. Brandon is Senior Director of Innovation for University Hospitals Ventures, an organization charged with deploying healthcare innovation at scale. He's the author of The Value Proposition Matrix, something we're certain to get into today. Brandon, welcome to the Product Quest podcast.
I am delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Let's start with University Hospitals Ventures. Tell us a little bit more about it and its mission.
Yeah, happy to. University Hospitals Ventures, or UH Ventures, is the innovation, product development, and investment arm of University Hospitals. We help our clinicians develop products. We help folks who are external to the organization find their way in and help advance their innovations. We support product development from the outside in, meaning if someone has a product that they've got on their mind and would like a living laboratory to test it in, UH Ventures supports that. And we also advance the systems innovation priorities more broadly, which is generally where I spend most of my time.
Yeah. It's interesting. So a lot of the things you described, well, let me ask you one question first. Where do they get their ideas from?
Oh boy, all corners of the world. And yeah. I would say, so first of all, and we have 30,000 people in working in the system. And wow. So the amount of brain power involved in making healthcare better, which it desperately needs to be in the US for sure, is tremendous. And so we are open to all angles of innovation. We are always listening to our outside partners, but we've generally, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this too, we've generally started to shift our focus not toward let's go find the next great idea, but let's go find the next great problem. And let's really get good at that. And then we gather the energy and the resources and the people we need to attack the next stage, which is that what we call a solution hypothesis, right? Yeah. So we'll talk a lot more about it, but it's a great question to ask. Where do you get your ideas? And more we're looking for great problems, which in healthcare turns out they're everywhere.
Yeah, a shortage of those. Well, you'll certainly get a lot of agreement with on our end with the finding problems first. So let me ask you that. Where do you find your problems?
Oh, where do we find our problems? We're going through a journey, I'd say. Folks don't knock on our door with problems. They knock on our door with solutions most of the time, whether they're internal or external, whether they're a vendor or an innovator, an entrepreneur, a clinician inside. We're all conditioned to bring problems, bring solutions, not problems, right? How many of us were told, like, don't bring me a problem, unless you bring me in to solve it, right?
Right, yeah.
That's I think, really, I think it's scrambled the circuits of innovators who feel like they have to bring something to the table if they're going to bring up a great problem to solve. And so it's hard to find problems because the vocabulary and the muscle memory out there for the organization, the institution, isn't really there. So the first thing we have to do is make it okay to talk about problems and to make it normal to say, hey, I see this issue and I'm not sure how to solve it, but let's get to the root of that problem first, right? And uncover and unpeel what it means to talk about a problem. Culturally, I'd say at the highest level, we're doing a lot of work there. But I can tell you guys, we're doing a lot of really detailed and mechanistic work around how to gather problems. There are some really awesome tools that are really new. I mean, AI is not, it's everybody's talking about it right now, and we're seeing applications all over. But one of those places is this idea of using large language models and natural language processing to help go through the conversation, talking to somebody about maybe an idea that they bring to us and backtracking into a problem, not using kind of the static form, the classic, like, hey, fill out this thing and stick it into the idea box. You get four fields. but a dynamic conversation that allows us to then organize our problems in a way that helps us bring body and life to them, and maybe go out and find more problems or bring external information about that problem, build it all up, and then let us take a look and start to prioritize it. So that's everything from the big culture stuff all the way to the really mechanistic stuff around gathering them piece by piece.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about this AI and the language models. How is that? What would you have been doing without it, and how? What are you doing differently with it?
Yeah. So what we were doing without it was the pretty standard sort of call for what used to be called call for ideas, right?
Yeah.
For that reason that, right? It,
Yeah.
let's
Yeah.
bring us your solutions, not your
Yeah.
problems. And we've shifted it to call for innovation. There's a form that you fill out. It's a period of time. You can always go fill it out, but there's really this kind of big push at a certain time of year. And you'd go out and
Yeah.
you'd kind of gather these. And it's pretty standard stuff. I mean, I've seen it in lots of corporate environments. But I'd say the shift now is into this place of, instead of that sort of static, here, fill out your idea form and submit it to us. And then we go through it piece by piece and say, hey, which ones sparkle to us? We're saying, hey, let's start with this notion that you don't necessarily have to come to us with all the answers or even a good knowledge about how to the kind of the anatomy of a good problem statement, right? We've talked a lot about that. This notion of a good problem statement has some anatomy. It has some pieces and parts that include, like, give us a quick, can you give us the one sentence? Can you give us the one place? Can you tell us who's feeling the pain in this scenario and how often it occurs and where it occurs and maybe even when it doesn't occur, and if there's any analogs that you've seen where you've said, oh boy, that problem exists in this, industry or space or whatever. The dimensions of a great problem statement are hard to define. They don't come easily to people. People don't talk about problems naturally. And so a language model and an interaction with an AI tool that we have been training can allow us to say, you know what, just start telling us about your problem. Can we ask about this a little bit? Does this sound right? And we actually, as they give us just a, even if they just tell us about their idea, actually, it's fun.
Yeah.
Just tell us what you're here for. Da, 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 da. They can fill that out. We can turn that into a summarized problem statement using prompt engineering in pretty short order, which is great. And then we present it to them and say, is this right? Does this look good? And they'd say, well, you know what? It's a little bit different. Can I? And we'd say, great, who else might know about this problem? And they'll say, oh, well, this colleague and this person. Automatically, we'll reach out to them and say, hey, someone has said you know about this problem. Can you have a conversation with us about it? And away you go. So that's the difference between that static form that just kind of gets stacked up. The other problem with the static form is that those come in all different levels, right? A problem needs to be leveled. It's high, it's too high level, it's too low level, it's too granular. We're looking for this Goldilocks zone. You can AI can help normalize that by not just helping ask better questions about scaling down a problem or scaling up a granular issue, but it can also go and find more and build a more robust problem statement.
That's absolutely fascinating. Is there an example that you could talk us through? I mean, I get what you're talking about the breadth and high, bigger problems versus narrower problems. And I've personally found that, well, this thing you just described, people are often they're this is not even something they think about, like problems at different levels. And so I found it takes a bit of conversation around that. Is there an example you can give of where, I mean, some of this might be too secretive, so don't worry about it if not, but is there an example you could give of where how the language model has helped you arrive at that proper level?
So, and I'll give you actually two different sides. So one is there's a proper leveling, right? Going up or down. And the other is kind of stripping out what we call bias and blame and sort of reframing, if you want. We're kind of working on that word reframing, but generally it's reframing. So let me actually start with reframing first, and then we'll kind of the leveling. Because the reframing stuff tends to be the hardest to get people their minds around. Like the leveling, it's like, okay, you know what? We can't make money on Medicare patients. Okay, that's a
It's a heck of a statement.
you can't start with that problem. Or access is a big issue. Like, okay, like access is the monster problem, right? You need to go kind of down from that and ask, okay, what part and what piece? In the same way, and I guess I'm going on the leveling path for a second for you, but in the same way that maybe a very specific, like this patient had an issue accessing this particular specialist, and we really want to solve that, right? So there's a difference between like patients don't have access to the right care, and this patient in this moment had this issue with this systematic interaction, right? There's a middle ground there where we can go and say, okay, when are you imagining this access taking place? Who is feeling that pain? When is it occurring? And then going up from, okay, how often does that occur for more patients? And when does that exist? And that's a real example. We're exploring access right now and finding that one of our key problems has come down to basically saying, look, during a sick visit, if you have a cold or flu, you wake up in the morning, you feel like crap. You want instant access to, like, there's a window of time. Like, you don't want to go and be tossed into an endless string of phone calls and like and be told that you can be seen in 3 days. Like, that's not going to help. Like, you need help right away. What's the best way to get them there? And so by going right down to a moment in time for a patient, we're able to get to that place of kind of leveling between like access is an issue and this patient had this problem. So now let's talk about this notion of kind of stripping out bias and blame. I give you another example. We heard right one of the problems we were looking at, again, this is just example. I mean, there's many, but it came to us and someone said, you know what, our staff hoards wheelchairs. I'm like, what do you mean our staff hoards wheelchairs? They're like, we can never find wheelchairs, and they're super expensive, and so staff will take and hoard them because they know if there's not a wheelchair available when they need them, then the patient needs to be discharged, is going to be a few hours late or angry or just and all that, it's a problem, right? So they hoard these wheelchairs. So what's wrong with this problem statement? If we took it as a problem statement and just said, like, what's wrong with that? Well, there's several things wrong with that. First of all, you're blaming somebody, right? And you're implying that there's a solution involved in that, which is to stop patients from hoarding wheelchairs. So there's two things, right? You're blaming somebody and you're implying a solution. It's actually a solution masquerading as a problem statement. Because the solution is stop staff from hoarding wheelchairs. Now, if we just took that as face value as an innovation organization and said, we need to stop staff, what do you do?
You
Like,
have
what
some
do you
kind of
do?
checkout system or something.
You police it, right? You police it. Like, oh, you put cameras up and you like, disincent people and you like scare them, right? That's a heavy iron solution to a problem that is not even a problem as defined in the way we want it defined. So let's try stripping it out. Let's go like one layer down. Say, instead of staff hoards wheelchairs, you can say something like, well, it's really hard to find wheelchairs. Okay, so now it's really hard to find wheelchairs. There's no person involved in that. It's more the system. And that's principle number one for us. It's principle number one, especially it's true in every industry I've been a part of, but it's really true in healthcare, which is don't blame the person, blame the system. Right? Like the Air Force has started to really shy away from pilot error issues versus plane design issues for this reason, because these pilots are highly trained. Like they don't show up to work to bail out of a multi-million dollar aircraft, right? They show up to do their job. And if the button's in the wrong place or the system's malfunctioning somehow, it's the system's fault, not the person's fault. And so likewise, our staff don't show up to hoard wheelchairs. Like that's not why they got into medicine, right? They got into medicine
Most of
to
them probably.
help, right? For most of them, like some of them are like, serious hoarders. But they get into medicine to help people. And so you got to say, look at this system issue. Then let's say instead of like, all right, it's hard to find wheelchairs, you got to ask like, well, why is it hard to find wheelchairs? Right? Like go to the level of, all right, wheelchairs are being put into the system. Why is it hard to find them? And if you twist that problem state into, well, it turned and look at it and go and do some watching, and I'm sure you guys are involved in this too. You really look at where the wheelchairs go, because one of our thesis were was that theses were that people were stealing them, that they would roll out of the institution because they had nowhere to go and they were just doing an analog to this problem is in retail. I used to work at Target corporate, and one of the things we saw all the time is people would steal the shopping carts because they had nowhere to go. They had to walk home. So take them and then stay at home, right? And it cost millions of dollars a year. Same thesis. Turns out we knew where all our wheelchairs were. Patients were sitting in them. Why is that? Because it was the most comfortable place to sit, and they weren't offered a different place to sit when they were moved from place to place. So when you were moved down to the front to be potentially put into the passenger seat, you weren't given a comfortable couch to sit on or an appropriate sitting place for your given condition. You were just told, be right back. So it turns out most of our wheelchairs were around. They're just sitting in them. So the solution to this problem, if you put, well, first of all, let's start with a problem statement, which is patients don't have comfortable places to sit other than wheelchairs, which leads to us having all our wheelchairs in use all the time, which leads to staff feeling like there may just sort shortage, which leads to the hoarding. So now you have a design problem that is much more system focused. There's no blame involved, right? And it gets to the heart of what you're doing versus having a solution in mind first. You don't know what the solution is when you say staff don't have a comfortable or patients don't have a comfortable place to sit. There's lots of ways to solve that. So this is a that's a long way of telling you, like, there's a and the example you're looking for of, let's strip out the things that make problem statements kind of insidiously difficult to work with, and then let's level them correctly. Now, I'm not saying that an AI can do all of that by itself. That is not, this is not like magic AI talk here. This is us saying there's really hard work in terms of design and ethnography and real empathy to go and dig into the problems that we get. But at least we can help systematically organize those problems in a way that they look like each other and they level like each other. And we can actually systematically and with an AI strip out some of the bias. It's really fun. Like, we've taught it how to say, no, that's blaming something or somebody instead of the system. Rearrange that and go from there.
So you're using AI to help craft the statement in a way of,
Exactly right. It's exactly right. We're using AI to help craft the problem statement because we find that's one of the hardest things to do. It's one of the hardest things for people to do is craft a robust problem statement that is comparable to others in a way that we can actually work with it, because we end up making all sorts of assumptions when it's just a, tell us your idea and let's just kind of look at it and see what to do next.
So could we maybe just break down what the dimensions of a good problem statement are for you? I think you mentioned a few before, but such that they are comparable, as you mentioned.
This is a great question. And I've actually, I wouldn't say struggle. We've just been working on it a lot because I don't know if there's like a, there's no agreed upon definition of a robust problem statement or the anatomy of problem statement. So, your mileage may vary when it comes to our attempt to try and put this into pieces. But here's how we think about it. It's that one sentence statement of, can you give us the short and sweet version of what's going on, right? Patients don't have a comfortable place to sit and instead use their wheelchairs. And then we ask, okay, tell us about the pain that this causes. Now, pain is different than cost. I don't need to know about the dollars. I don't need to know about the time. I need to know about the anguish. I need to know about the frustration, the fear, the pain, like the physical pain, something that's dangerous. I mean, anything that creates pain, and we want to locate on that. And then we want to ask, okay, who's experiencing that the most frequently every day? We'll get back to why that's important in a minute, but where is that pain concentrated? And now, how often does it occur? Is it all the time? Is it once a month? Tell us how often, and in what context? So when? Pretty simple. And then there's these other elements of, if you know the costs that we see from this issue, can you please tell us? And a lot of people don't. So we try to be very careful about that one. A lot of clinicians, for example, won't know that it costs the hospital X millions of dollars a year to replace wheelchairs because, you know, we keep thinking we're losing them or whatever. So they'll get lost in that question if you're not careful about it, but cost. As I said, when does it not occur? So exceptions. So we're looking for these moments in time where, boy, this problem isn't a problem in this particular case. And those are wonderful questions, because if you do get somebody to bite on that one and give you a, oh, well, it doesn't happen here, it's great. For example, we were just talking with someone who is saying, you know what, this particular issue with access is not an issue in peds, in pediatrics, because the people answering the phone are so much more compassionate about this when it's a kid. And we're like, why? And you're like, it's just magic when it's a kid. So what is it about it's helping an adult? So that's what you get when you ask, like, give me an exception, because suddenly you unlock like an issue that is driving. It could be a driver. It's not always, but it could be. And then of course that, as I got back to this sort of analog, which was what I was talking about with retail shopping carts and the wheelchairs, it's, you know, do you know anywhere else this exists? That's not often when we get from folks, but when you get a really innovative person, that they might offer that. But so there's kind of two tiers to the anatomy. There's the basics, which are not mind-blowing, right? They're just, it's amazing how hard it is for people to sort of organize those. And then there's some context setting ones. The real magic comes in when we get all those elements together and then start stripping out the bias and the blame and leveling.
Can I maybe jump in here? I find this super fascinating, because I think we pretty much, especially in medicine, we know how to describe a solution, but we're just starting as it is. I mean, there's all this requirement, engineering, all that stuff. Problem is something new to many, many. Well, just thinking about it is already a start. But I have a hard time when I try to understand problems of customers or clients is when to stop. Like when do you know you have caught the actual cause of the problem? So in the wheelchair example, you could say, well, I don't know if that is really the case, but how would you go about this? You could say, well, okay, we found that the issue is that not other options to sit down are not available to patients. Now you could say, well, that's because the hospital doesn't have enough money or something like that. So in fact, the actual problem is that we need to get more financing, and then how do we get more? And suddenly we're in politics. So how do you know when and where to stop, if you know what I'm trying to get at?
Such a good question. Oh my God, I love it. So let's take that example you talked about, right? Is you get all the way down to this place where, like, patients don't have comfortable places to sit, and so they're using the wheelchairs and they're all in use. If you go down the path of, well, why is that? And you start to feel yourself going back up, which is, well, we don't have enough money to pay for couches or chairs or a place. And why is we don't have enough money? Because we have revenue and cost concerns. And why don't we have that? Because we don't make any money on Medicare patients. And why is that? Because the whole healthcare system is messed up. If you find yourself kind of bottoming out in that why search, I'm always looking for kind of the bottom of the curve. Now, that is not mathematics. That is just good old fashioned, like, kind of eyeballing it.
But I know exactly what
you kind of know. And the other part of that is, if you get to the place where you can run the smallest experiment you can imagine that will yield meaningful insights, stop there and try it. Because that's what we're really getting at, right? I mean, I don't want to imply to anybody. I've had people say, you know, Brandon, you're just kind of annoying. All you're doing is, like, dealing with like eluciding problems. Like, what, aren't you the innovation guy? Like, don't you come up with anything? Like, I do, but I want it to be this experimental moment where we can be really efficient with our time so that we can kick out bad ideas, right? Because that's what you're actually driving towards. Like, I'm not just the problem gatherer with no solution mind in mind or a drive towards fixing things. Like I want to fix things, but what I want to do is fix them with experiments. And that's the other piece of your question is after you kind of bottom out in this Y sort of curve, the Y is in W-H-Y, not Y. if you bottom out and then you find that you can imagine an experiment that would determine whether that's, and this is why this example is fun because there is an experiment you could run. Could we reimagine the sitting environment of our core patient sitting rooms, go where a bunch of people are sitting in wheelchairs and say, can we change that? And see if it works and see if it frees up wheelchairs. And maybe it not. Maybe people really are walking out with wheelchairs. What's the next experiment to run? Well, let's put some trackers on them. Let's see where they go. So again, it's about finding the lowest common denominator in terms of an experiment and then running it.
You remind me of, I guess it's Lean Startup sort of pretends like they invented it, but it's an older concept. But you remind me of just the idea of listing all the assumptions with something. Is that like all the assumptions with your experiments? Is that part of your process as well?
Yeah, I would say that especially when it comes to experimenting, we really want to understand the assumptions we're making for several reasons. One, just to make sure that we have a really clear perspective that we're answering the key questions we need to know. And part of my book actually talks about this, and we use some of that methodology too, is kind of where are the key assumptions. We also find those key assumptions to be a really important part of the ROI conversation, because make no mistake, in healthcare, if we're going to go and tackle a problem, you might ask like, well, which problems do you tackle first? And we try to tackle the ones that are going to have the most impact and they're most feasible to solve, right? So if you kind of imagine a little 2x2, a really high impact and really high feasibility is kind of the sweet spot, what we call an ignite problem. And that feasibility stuff is really about design. It's really like, do we have the people, processes, and technology today in place to solve this problem? Like sometimes there's a problem and you're like, that's not feasible to solve today for all sorts of reasons. Maybe our technology stack is not where it needs to be. So we have to tackle that issue first. But when it comes to impact, you really want to be able to talk about ROI. And when you talk about ROI, you want to be able to talk about your assumptions because you want to be able to say, hey, we believe this and we believe that, because people will pick holes in every ROI conversation. They'll say, oh, what do you mean? Like that, you know, you're going to save nurses time. Okay, well, what are they going to do with that time? Go out and, you know, extra smoke breaks? Like what assumptions are you making about that gives you the credibility you need to move forward? So that's another place where assumptions become crucially important.
Man, I 100% agree. One argument I've got with people is the value over building a net present value model or a return on investment model. And people put out, it's not accurate, but I'm like, but at least if you list the assumptions, I think it's going to be this, we have to do all that. And if something's wrong by whatever percentage, we get at least an order of magnitude. And so anyway, that's sort of a little different angle, but that's where I've seen. And then we'll argue about how big the markets can grow. We'll argue about the assumptions and then the end number. The end number is certainly wrong. I have no doubt about. But
This quote I've already mentioned, but I really like it's going to sound very pompous, by this Henri Bergson, a philosopher, and he says a speculative problem is solved as soon as it is properly stated. And I think that's quite an interesting idea. And so I was wondering, in this wheelchair example, you basically, as you go push down and go down in the Y's, you get to this idea that people are sitting on wheelchairs because they have nowhere else to sit. And then, so obviously here, you know that, well, maybe we need to create places for people to sit. So somehow you've already designed a bit the solution in this process. I was wondering, how do you go about problems that are, let's say, potentially more complex? How do you go about finding providers for solutions? I believe both of these things might be linked. I was just wondering.
Yeah, you bet. That great question. So you're right. I'm using the wheelchair example as kind of a simple model, right? To sort of underpin what we do. I mean, it is a live and real example, but let's take a different one, which is our nurses are over capacity, and we will never be able to train, hire, or employ as many as we need ever again. That's because the way the population is aging, the way the industry is changing, the way the costs are going, the way that nurses are choosing or people are choosing to become or not become nurses, is leading in a trend that we just never we believe we're never going to turn that around. We don't believe there will ever be a surplus of nurses again. So what do we do about that? Like, that's a problem. Now, you could tell me, well, Brandon, that kind of sounds like Medicare, sort of we're never going to, but it's not actually. It comes down to this notion of our nurses don't have enough capacity in their day-to-day work, and we believe there are solutions we can try to solve them. Now, which parts of their work we can be specific about, and we kind of get into sub-problems. But one of these aspects is, and this is live, we're doing this today, is we said, look, it takes a ton of time to admit, transfer, and discharge patients. It takes a ton of time to walk in and out of rooms. It takes a ton of time to grab another nurse and verify another medication. It takes a ton of time for a nurse to sit in a room and watch a patient. Like, we went through and we said, like, what are all the parts of a nurse's day that are just demolishing their time? I listed a bunch of them. We call these sub-problems within that sort of broad problem statement. And then we said, well, is there a solution out there that, first of all, can we imagine building a solution on our own? And we started with this assumption that technology would be an important part of this equation, that the human beings and processes could not be made more efficient than they are today on their own, that technology somehow would be involved. Well, could we bring technology to bear on our own? Well, first, we'd like to go and look for solutions in the market, right? I mean, we like to say, let's buy something before we go and build it. So we went through a sprint diligence process. Now, diligence processes are not new. I'm not inventing this, but we basically said, we're going to canvas the market quickly. We have a capacity in the ventures team called Outside In. It's run by a tremendous team. They do an amazing job, and they know way more than you think about all these different vendors. And we asked them, like, who's out there doing this? We also asked some of our executives, like, who do you know in this space? And a short list came up pretty quickly of folks who are applying cameras and microphones and AI in hospital rooms to become what is effectively a force multiplier for nursing staff. We were intrigued by this solution. We were intrigued by the list of vendors. We got to know them and went through the process of seeing their tech and demoing things, visiting some of their sites, learning from the people who were using this tech, and realized that it's, first of all, it's very much at its infancy. Their cameras are not new in hospital rooms, microphones to some degree, but using that all to create and use AI and also create kind of this virtual nursing space it's kind of on the bleeding edge of where hospital systems are going. And so we gathered that together, did a diligence exercise, and said, who's going to be able to help be the right fit for us as a partner? Who's going to be willing to go to the forefront of technology and try the newest stuff with us? And we landed on a vendor, and we have been designing this with them. I can tell you that we're going to be running a hundred and we're going to put this system in it's going to be watching 130 beds starting in May, which is it's a big pilot. We're going to be running a side-by-side clinical study that will help inform the rest of the industry, because what we found is that we went out and looked at the industry data, and it was basically a bunch of people saying, yeah, we put this stuff in and it saved a bunch of money, but it was all anecdotal and mostly from the vendors, right? It was mostly like the vendors would say, oh, our client saved this, or our client saved this.
Sure.
We know that to change our own system and convince them that it's scalable, but also to change other healthcare systems and enable them to change as well, we need to do a clinical study. Now, that is a huge lift, and it is the team that's helping me accomplish this, going through the IRB and working, and there's FDA involved. I mean, it is a lift, but it is worth it. because it is going to give us this a platform upon which to build, if it is successful, in a way that really addresses kind of the heart of the original question, which is like, what are we doing with, how are we bringing the technology, the best technology, to bear on the best problems? And the best technologies and the best problems, I think, become platforms. They become a problem that is broad enough to have lots and lots of depth, but also a platform solution that can go on and on. Because when I can tell you what I tell you, what I can tell you about the number of use cases that we've discovered in this, it's not just, hey, we can have a nurse there virtually when another nurse walks into the room and needs a hand. We can use AI to predict whether somebody's going to fall and then alert the virtual nurse that this looks like behavior that is fall. Now, I'm not going to tell you how many falls happen in our hospital system, but I can tell you it's more than they should be. And that's every hospital system in the country. And when it happens, excruciatingly expensive, and way worse than that, it's often very, very dangerous. If we can cut that number down significantly, it is a game changer. And that's just one use case. We can go on and on down the number of use cases that this platform provides us. So it's again, another long answer to a really great question, which is, we are really serious about finding technologies that become platforms upon which problems can be solved in multiple directions.
Wow, that's awesome. You remind me of something. By the way, so in the projects I've done in healthcare, I'll tell you what I love about it, and I'll tell you what I find frustrating about it. Then I'm going to ask your advice. This is counselor, yeah. This is Brandon, yeah. Counselor time.
All right.
What I love about it, especially for when like the people are so knowledgeable, physicians, surgeons, I mean, they can describe what they're doing in such detail, with such precision, and they'll go as deep, and it's almost, as opposed to interviewing other types of customers, they really enjoy it. They seem to really, some especially, they go real deep. That's what I love about it. Now, I mean, here's the thing that I find frustrating is when you're investigating problems, sort of similar to what you said, we end up a lot of times with this, but the payer will only this, or the payer will only that. And that just becomes this huge blocker. And it's like whatever we were trying to move the needle on, it just dies on this, but the payer won't do it. So what advice do you had? What would you advise in those situations? It becomes such, it's just such a killer of the whole conversation, but it's like the payers run everything. And then we feel helpless and powerless to even do anything.
So right, man. This is
that's a big one. Sorry,
this is a hot one. Yeah. And I'm not going to shy away from it. I will tell you, I hear it a lot. Right, the payer provider dynamic. In the U.S. and I can't speak internationally, but I'm gathering the similar dynamics. Right, create this world in which the scope of our control gets constricted in our minds. Mm. Like, and it starts to be this magic boogeyman that we use to just shut down everything because it's the payer's fault. And sometimes if it's not the payer, it's the patient. Like there's one that won't adopt. Like, and there's this blame going on. And I find that in our world, when we ask about the problem we're solving and we're relentless about the problem first, it doesn't solve this payer issue, but it incorporates this notion that what is within our scope of control is where we're focused, right? So if you get a problem statement that's starting to be like, well, it's the payer's fault and we can't do this, you're kind of on the wrong track because it's not feasible to solve. Remember, I talked about impact and feasibility.
Yeah.
Well, you just go along the feasible path and you just move that back. Now, if you're getting to the place where you're saying, look, it's just the payer's fault, ask the question a different way and say, given what is in our scope of control, let's talk about the problem we're trying to solve. And now I can't speak to your exact issue. Like, this is not going to be a magic conversation fixer. Yeah. It's like, hey, the payer just won't pay for this really great product that we want to develop. But I can say that ultimately finding and fixing the problem inside the system that you're operating starts to expand the scope of control because it gives you a perspective on working within your means instead of constantly just looking at the world as one big constriction. I find this kind of endemic in terms of healthcare strategy generally. Like it's just like you can see some organizations or some folks talking about it, and it's just like it's everybody else's fault but ours. That might be true.
Yeah.
That still doesn't change the fact that there are a gazillion problems to solve inside your system.
Yeah.
And many of those are way more in your control than you think.
Focus on what's in your control.
What's in your control. Now I'd have to get into your specific sort of scars and battle wounds to really help it all beyond sort of the broad brush of that answer. But you're not wrong. It's a huge issue.
We could keep going with healthcare, but only because I want to move on to your book, because I want to make sure we save time for that. The value proposition matrix, I really enjoyed it. It's a term. We have these terms that we hear a lot, the value proposition, and that's certainly one of them. So just for level setting for folks listening, you know, how do you define a value? What is a value position, value proposition, and what separates a good one from a not as good one, a bad one?
Oh, this is great. This is what a wonderful tee up. So you're right. This is a term we hear a lot. Yeah. To me, it's a value proposition is the offer an organization makes to its customers that sets it apart from its competition. And that is, it's important that I use the word organization, because it's not just a company. Organizations of all kinds have value propositions, whether it's the Cleveland Institute of Art down the street, whether it's the US government, whether it's Apple, Google, they all have a value proposition there. They believe that they are offering the world something, an experience, a product, that is different and somehow unique to based on the competitive landscape and what it offers. So that's what we're really looking for when we're looking for a great value proposition. I've spent a lot of time in this space working with innovators. I, generally speaking, the way I describe the work I've done over the course of my career and continue to do is I build innovation systems. So I work with whether it's ecosystems of startups, or whether it's within my own startup, or whether it's with a hospital system or a retailer or a manufacturer. They all have innovation systems, and that's what I work on. And in that innovation system, we need vocabulary to describe those innovations. And innovators really struggle, not just with the problem statement. So we went really deep on the problem statement, but innovators often struggle like to just tell you what they want, imagine they're going to bring to the world. Now, this is a weird thing, right? Like you would think that innovators would just instantly be able to give you that beautiful elevator speech that just like nails it. Like we fix this for this and this and this. But the vast majority of time they do not. And because there's so much knowledge rattling around in their head and so many dynamics that they're working on and so much is changing all the time that it's really, really hard to talk about a value proposition in a crisp way. They're also been given tools by established innovation experts that are great tools. I mean, you mentioned one of them, Lean Startup, Eric Ries, book right there, love it. Or the business model canvas, right, is another one. You've all seen that, right? You ask an innovator fill out your 9 interconnected boxes, and you'll have a perfect picture of your business model. Okay,
right.
Love it. The insight is great, but it still doesn't get to the heart of what the hell are you trying to do with your idea? Like, what is the central value? How's it different? How's it set you apart? What's the offer you're making? So the 4 pieces that I've distilled in my experience working with innovators and with students, I've taught for 8 years at the Case Western Reserve's Weatherhead School of Management. And in working with students and innovators, these 4 things that I mentioned in the book really, really come through. It's, can you tell me who's your customer, primarily your first customer, if I can get there, right? Who's that first one? Who do you want to talk to? Who's the one person to get in the room? What problem are you solving for them? What's your unique solution? And what assets are you bringing to the table to deliver it? In other words, who's your team? If you can tell me those 4 things, you get in an elevator with me and say, this person has this problem, we solve it this way, and this is why, because I've got this, this, and this. That's a great start when it comes to a value prop.
Yeah, but that's super difficult to get there. I think it's hard. It's really hard to get it that crisp. I think especially if you have that. I mean, at least the startups I encounter are it or people kind of working on an idea are their mind is all about the solution. Right. It's all about, and they can tell you, describe the solution in all its beautiful technical detail, but who is it for? Why should they care about it? So, but I love the simplicity of it, but I think it's the simplicity is exactly what makes it super difficult to pin down.
It's true. And it depends on the environment, right? So in some cases you might find an innovator who's just great about describing the target. But when it comes to describing the solution, it kind of gets a little vague and sort of winds away because they're imagining this kind of problem they've experienced. And they're not quite sure how to get there. So I've seen it in other ways. The dynamic you're describing around the solution being the place they focus, I tend to see this in R&D. I see it in academia. I see it like this is where I see a lot of focus, and generally the weight, I'd say it's 80-20 in terms of, you're right, the overfixation on the solution, because there's this other, so we've talked about innovation tropes, right? We heard like, don't bring me a problem, bring me a solution. The worst one ever is if you build a better mousetrap, the world will beat its way to your door. Well, not true, right? It isn't. If people are only spending their time on the mousetrap, like, who's the mousetrap for? Right. What problem is the mousetrap solving? Why is it better? What makes you a good mousetrap inventor? Because you had the idea in the shower? No, because you have 50 years experience in the industry? Okay, maybe. Like, so there's all these other components beyond just a great solution. And I think there's a hypocritical notion in the innovation world that there's this brilliant idea, and if you just capture it and set it down and wrestle it to the ground and bring it to life, you will be successful. And what this matrix is trying to do is say, no. There are so many other pieces of the puzzle. Illuminate those, and they will shine more light on the others' pieces, and that it will fit together in a way that a foundation fits together, as in four walls that you sit on versus just the one, hoping the others will come.
And in your experience of these four different pillars, so who's the customer, what problem are you solving, what's the solution, and who are you, who's your team, which one of these in your experience have you found the most difficult to pin down?
Yeah. So I usually draw a line through the matrix because, well, let me actually illuminate it a little more and go one layer deeper. Each of them have their own challenges. I'd say, as we just discussed, the problem by itself, and we just spent how much time talking just about the problem statement, right? That's just one piece of this puzzle, really difficult. The who is the customer? I think that might seem easy, but it takes a lot of sort of digging. The solution can be hard on its own, of course, right? I mean, depending on the technology you're working with, it can take years to get there, and assembling a team. I mean, some people would say that's your toughest task, and it's the one that people assume they can get right away. It's like, oh yeah, I can find somebody who can code in Python. Yeah, go for it. See how that works for you. So each of them have their own issues, but the reason I like to draw a line is because the matrix actually illuminates some key assumptions. And this is where I see people spending their time or not spending their time. So without going into too much detail, let me just give the assumptions you find. So basically, when you say, I have this customer and they have a problem, you're assuming that it's an important problem. You're saying, hey, this is a problem that needs to be solved. It's a burning problem. Okay. There's another assumption you're making, and it sits right between solution your problem and your solution, which is that it actually works, right? That it actually solves the problem. You're making another assumption, and that is between your team and the solution, which is that you can deliver it, right? You're assembling some way that you can deliver it. And you're making a fourth assumption, if you're still with me. Sorry if I've lost you. That fourth assumption is between your team and the customer, and that's that you can sell it. Okay, so can you sell it? Yeah. Is it an important problem? Does it work? And can you deliver it? Okay, simple. Now, you're saying, where do you see people spending a lot of time? I see people obsessing over what I call the supply assumptions. The supply assumptions are those two assumptions, which does it work and can I deliver it? Because they believe that if it works, as in the mousetrap is awesome, and I can, and I have all the manufacturing I need, then the world will beat its way to my door. And when I worked in manufacturing, I helped build an innovation ecosystem for manufacturing startups in Northeast Ohio. The number one question I would get is not, "Hey, can you help me with my strategy? Hey, can you help me find the right customer?" It was, "Can you help me make 50,000 of these? Because I know if I had 50,000, everybody would buy them." Right? Or, "Hey, can you help me develop the first prototype? Because I know if I just had a prototype, I could get an investor to invest in my idea," right? They obsess on the supply assumptions, but let me talk about the demand assumptions for a minute. Will anybody buy it? And is this an important problem? Why don't people spend their time there? Because those are super scary problems and they're not in your control. They're not in your control. You know what is in your control? You can go buy manufacturing. Manufacturing. You can work on your prototype in your four walls without asking anybody what they think forever. It's super comfortable, and all you have to do is spend time and money doing it. You know what's super uncomfortable? Is this a problem you care about? Can I actually talk to you about your, can I get empathy, right? Can I understand you? You know what's really super scary? Will you buy this? This thing I just built, will you buy it? Not would you buy it.
Will you buy it?
Will you buy it?
Yeah.
Those terrify people. No, right. And you get no all the time. And you get, oh, yeah, that's not a problem. And you get, because those aren't in your control. But you make assumptions about those things in the world, the demand assumptions. And that leads you to this process of obsessing over the supply assumptions to get there, because that's all what's really in your control. We need innovators to get out of their control mindset. We need them to go out there and say, "I don't know if it's going to work, but I'm going to try to sell it. I don't know if it's going to work, but I'm going to ask lots of questions about the problem to get better understanding there." That's where we need people to go. I'm not saying you shouldn't develop prototypes and build your supply chain. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying you got to get out there and ask the hard questions that scare the hell out of you, because you get to the answers much faster instead of wasting all your time and money building something nobody wants.
I love that. Yeah.
When I was reading your book, going through those four questions, there was something about that first question. I'm telling you, it just stopped me in my tracks. I want to tell you what it was. You didn't say, "Who is your customer?" You said, "Who is your first customer?" That word "first" is what I just like stopped what I was doing. And I just had to think about that for a second. I wonder if you could have a sense of it, but could you elaborate why, instead of just "Who is your customer," why you chose to word it that way? Who is your first customer?
Yeah. I often ask my students if they can spot that word, and if it jumps out to them, because I think, and thank you for bringing it up, I think it's really important. That first customer it's kind of this classic early adopter framework, but it's set up in a different way, right? We all know that an early adopter cohort is really important, right? The ones that are going to find you, they've got that problem so deep in their soul that they're like Googling it at night and working on, you know, hacks and trying to fix it. It's itchy.
Yeah.
That first customer crystallizes it because it helps give you that name. I often ask my entrepreneurs or people I'm working with, innovators inside the hospital, if there's one person that I could magically get in the room right now to tell you whether they would buy this product or not, who is it? Mm-hmm. Now, that it's amazing how fast people can be like, "Well, the Secretary of Defense." And I ask, "Okay, you get the Secretary of Defense in here. Great. Good use of the magic wand. They're not going to know. They're not going to know anything about what you're talking about."
Right.
"Who reports to them that might?" "Well, I don't know. Have you looked?" "No. Okay, let's go find that person." "All right. Is the director of X the right person?" "Well, I don't know. Who reports to them?" "Oh, that person. Do you think there's any chance in the world that you could actually talk to that person?" "Sometimes there is." So there's no chance you get the Department, the Secretary of Defense. But there might be the chance that you get the person who reports to 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 them, and then get you on the road to finding that initial person. But even if it's not a person, like that's mostly appropriate in like a B2B context, right? Where you've got this like buyer out there, this guy corporate buyer or this government buyer, whoever, entity buyer. But sometimes in a B2C world, that first customer becomes an ideal person, a cohort of people, right? A psychographic sort of collection of a mom with this and this and this and this. That first customer is nice because you can still ask that question, like, who is that person? Give me their name. Oh, their name is Sally. Why are you giving me this name, Sally? Because I actually know her. I'm imagining her. She's down the street. Now, this also helps because if the answer is, well, that customer is me, you say, go find another one.
Yeah.
Give me the name of the person that's not you. So it's also a tell when it comes to like, if they're imagining that they're solving their own problem, because you've got to find a customer out there that's beyond you who gets it. Yeah. And that's also a nice way to crystallize it by asking like, who's your first customer?
Yeah. I just think it's brilliant. Yeah. I think it makes, for me, it makes you have to get real specific. It makes you think, because you can use this word customer and you sort of think of segments and just categories of people. Yeah. And it just, you're almost letting yourself off the hook a little bit. But who is your first customer? It's just in that word, I feel like I have to focus more and I have to read like almost like, I'm not using focus metaphorically, almost like literally like see who that person is. And the other thing, and you alluded to this too, that I like about it is it applies. There's a second customer. It applies. I'm sort of gathering a beachhead with this, and then that there will be there. And again, maybe I'm projecting things, but I remember you referring to like Everett Rogers and adoption. So at least as I'm imagining it, it's like my first, and then who would be, it was funny. We were talking about Bitcoin when we were, before you got online. And so that would be interesting. Like the first customers of Bitcoin, if you will, were just sort of an odd selection of libertarians and highly technical people that were able to sort of do the things that were difficult to buy this, whatever it is. And then here it's 2024, there's an ETF now, a Bitcoin ETF, and now anybody can go on E-Trade. So it's like, I mean, there's maybe in between, but that just occurs to me like that first cut, the second customer and the first customer as it moves from adoption or incredibly different. But if they never had the first customer, there's not a second customer.
That is the key piece. And I will get people all the time saying, I don't want to tell you a first customer because I'm not selling to one customer. Everybody's going to want this thing. Everybody's going to want the product. Yeah, right. And I can get snarky and say, well, prove it. Give me one.
Yeah, right.
And or I can just say, you know what? Even Apple started with one, right? Apple started with one. You go way back, because they'll say Apple doesn't have a single customer. Apple's for everybody. You know, this thing, we've all got it in our pocket.
Yeah.
And you guys, I'm sure, know the story. Apple had those initial customers that go back and Google like the first Mac computer, and it looks like it was made out of wood. People in their basements who needed a personal computer. So I think it's, there's this, that's another part of the innovation lore that I'm trying to pull apart, because I don't want people thinking that there's this instant path to this whole world of buyers that are going to instantly buy a product. It's hard. It's gritty. It's one at a time. And if you can get that first insight, you'll learn a whole lot, because I guarantee you what that first customer wants isn't what you think they want. But it'll be a lot smarter. You'll be a lot smarter after you engage with them.
Yeah. I love it. Well, if we're going to get through one more of the questions, what unique product or offering? How important is it for it to be unique?
You know, I'd say it's important, but I want to readjust people's definition of unique.
Yeah.
Because people often go off the rails and think unique means patented and mind-blowing and world-changing. I've seen unique products be unique simply because they speak to a customer in a different way. They use different language. I've seen it be unique because it's in a different geography, an appropriate geography that was previously inaccessible. There are any number of ways to make it unique. I think what brings to life uniqueness are the other two puzzle pieces around, and actually the other three, which are the unique combination of that initial customer with their problem and the team that you have to deliver it, what makes it unique is the intersection of those other things. And that's what I want people to be able to describe. And that's why I bring uniqueness into it, because it really aligns the other three in a way that says, why you? What about, what is unique about this particular customer you have in mind? And what is it about their problem that is unique to this particular situation? Again, I don't mean to scare people away and think that, boy, if you don't have an idea that's going to change the world, forget it. It can be as simple as, I'm just putting it in a different context. We can all name dozens of products that are just the same as they've always been. They've just been packaged differently or put differently or right. aimed differently right. in a way that makes them new.
For me, this was the... Sorry, just the example that pops to mind that I really like is this is liquid. No, what is it? Liquid death, not liquid water. But I mean, it's liquid water death. Has been there. I don't know if you know it. Like there's these water cans that
with know it well.
Super different branding. And I mean, it's water, right? Anyway,
it's amazing. Let's just talk about liquid death for a minute. Okay, so if you talk about who's the first customer, okay?
Yeah.
My wife is she's a brilliant mind, a marketing strategist, and we sometimes talk about it. Liquid death is one of her favorites. So the words that are going to come out of my mouth are hers, which is going to sound way smarter than mine. She says that liquid death is aimed at people who didn't want to drink at events where it was awkward to not have a drink in your hand. So they made it look like beer,
wow,
look edgy, look sharp, and yet could be the kind of thing that you could be comfortable walking around a rock concert with and not look like you're holding a bottle of Dasani.
Yeah.
That who's the first customer? You know exactly who that person is. Yeah. What problem are you solving? Could not be sharper. What's the beautiful uniqueness about it? It's just freaking water, dude. But it's the packaging and what it's projecting. And the team, I guarantee you, if you go back and look, they will have assembled people who could design that thing and talk to that audience and get that manufactured. It's a beautiful example of how a simple value proposition can be an incredible mover in terms of value.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think
slogan, so murder your thirst.
Yeah, murder your thirst.
Yeah. I mean, of course, they're also a little bit kind of making fun of marketing as an idea, I think, in a sense. Yeah. But it's part of the brand, right? But I think it really shows the power of I would assume, and I have no clue, but I would assume that many of the other water brands that are out there are so much focusing on water quality, ingredients, all the beverage, which is natural that comes to them. And I know that this feeling, everybody I think knows this feeling, you're at an event and you're the weird guy that drinks water. So you feel stupid or, you know, and then
me. Yeah.
And it just clicks. So yeah.
Love it.
I just loved it. Yeah.
Great example. Yeah.
Fantastic. You know, as we're sort of wrapping up here, one of the things I really like about your book that just sort of occurred to me is like it's like we talked about Osterwalder's book, and we're just canvases, and there's canvas. Everybody's making canvases these days, but yours, I mean, you have this matrix, but really it's framed up in questions. It's almost like when I'm reading the book, I feel like you're the teacher, and it's like this very Socratic method of you ask questions. Now I have to think, who's my first customer? You know what? I have to answer these questions so we could put it in the matrix. But it's really, to me, the power really is in these very insightful questions. And then I think there's no better example than like the importance of that word first in there. So what, before we sort of wrap up here, what else would you like to let folks know about it? What's something I should have asked you that I didn't?
Oh man, I could go down so many rabbit holes. This conversation sort of feeds my soul in all sorts of ways. I love having these conversations. I would say that, and it's not that you're not asking, I would just say that, and I think we've touched on it a bit, I always want to leave any audience who are inspiring entrepreneurs or innovators with a little confidence in the fact that all the things that we're talking about are way harder in practice than they are in concept, right? And I just want to say, I work with innovators all the time. I've gotten my hands really bloody in corporate innovation and my own entrepreneurship. I've got the scars to prove it. This is hard stuff. My intent has always been to just make it a little easier in a way that brings clarity, and that's all, but not to imply that the road is not littered with broken glass and landmines, right? Yeah. So I think just know that, because we've all been there where it's like, oh, I have this magic thing, buy my book and it'll fix all your problems. Like, that's not what this is. This is not that. This is just a vocabulary tool set to help along a really hard road taken by really brave people. So I hope that comes across.
Awesome. Well put. And you just remind me of something. And when I'm working with teams, and then, like to describe a market or describe whatever, and it starts, all of a sudden things start to sound complicated and difficult, and I can almost sense people getting frustrated. I say something similar to what you did. Look, this is not easy. This is want them to, let's have a little patience with the process. And and one thing I really like that you emphasized is, just let's focus what's in our control. And again, with healthcare, the payer, there's a lot, I've got notes all over here, but removing blame out of the problem solving. I thought early on you mentioned that bias is something we talk about a lot, but blame, I don't know that I've heard that much. And so I think that was also a really important idea. We're blame, people get defensive, and then we're not getting to the heart of it. Well, awesome. Well, you can learn more about Brandon at his website, brandoncanuke.com. It's brandoncanuke.com. You can also learn more about UH Ventures at ventures.uhhospitals.org. All right, Brandon, we got one final question. We're gonna have a value proposition conference, and there's people from all over the world. They're coming, and you're hosting this value proposition conference. As part of it, we're all gonna watch a movie together. Now, this movie, it can be for educational purposes or for entertainment purposes, but you're picking the movie. What movie are we watching at your conference?
Oh man,
that's
a hard one. I, we could go one direction and watch The Matrix, right? We could do that one. One of my favorites. I will say, let's watch Moneyball. And if you go and watch Moneyball, you're going to see a person thinking about the problem in a different way, right? And there's a scene in there that I think brings it all together for us. If you go look at the scene where is it Dave Podesta is trying to pitch his idea to Billy Bean, right? The GM of the A's, and they're in a parking lot, and he's got that moment. He's got that elevator pitch moment. If you go through and look at the elements that we just talked about, you will see them all sitting there, right? Is who's the customer? Like it's baseball owners, and what problem are they solving? Well, it's an unfair game because there's not a salary cap, and what's the solution? Well, we need to buy runs, not buy players, and we can do that because you're in a position to do it because you're a GM. All those pieces are there. So not only do I love the movie and I love the message generally, but you'll find this littered through that movie. So let's watch that one.
We'll do that.
Great choice.
I have not seen Moneyball. So
oh,
guys, yeah, that's a great movie. Great movie. Yeah.
On the list.
I love it.
Yeah.
You're gonna love it.
Awesome. Well, as we wrap up here, I just have to offer highest praise for the value proposition matrix. And here's where if you're watching a video, I've got a lot of business books behind me. They're all in front of me. But very few become ones that actually are ones that I use as a reference. And this is one that I use as a reference. And that's the highest praise I can personally offer. So, Brandon, thanks for spending time with us today.
It's been fantastic. Thanks for having me.
And that, friends, concludes today's Product Quest podcast. Follow us on LinkedIn. Reach out to us at productquestpodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time. Man, that was great.
Thanks for having me, guys. This is really fun.
Thanks, Brandon.
Take care.
Thanks so much. Okay, bye.